From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. One of the most enduring images of the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina came from a report by NPR's Howard Berkus on yesterday's Morning Edition. Howard was reporting from the small community of Ocean Springs, Mississippi, and the efforts to rebuild that town. Among the debris along the waterfront, Ocean Springs Mayor Connie Moran pointed out for Howard that the Bradford pear trees were in bloom. "They're confused," she said. "They think it's springtime. So I try and focus on something positive, regeneration."
Moran acknowledges optimism is more elusive in some towns on the coast, which have little left to resurrect. Still, there are spring buds in the ruins on a sweltering September day in Ocean Springs, Mississippi.
Today in the program, NPR's Howard Berkus will join us to talk about the experience of covering the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Aside from his ability to use sound as a character in his stories, NPR's Howard Berkus has a gift of being able to find physical images that express not just what has happened, but their larger meaning. For nearly 2 weeks, Howard, who lives in Salt Lake City, has been covering the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina from the Gulf Coast of Mississippi. In one small Mississippi town, Howard described a highway lined with hundreds of cars and trucks, all askew, he wrote, as if tossed like dice. In yesterday's story from Ocean Springs, Howard finds another image in the remains of a highway and a bridge. The supports are still standing, but the panels holding pavement are gone. Imagine, says Howard, a shattered spine. Today in the program, Howard is joining us to talk about how he's covered one of the country's most devastating disasters. Along the way, he'll share some of the images, some of the voices and sounds of Mississippi's Gulf Coast as they struggle to rebuild their communities. We invite you to join the conversation. 585-WEST is the number, 585-9378. Our email address is radiowest@kuer.org. Howard Berkus is NPR's rural affairs correspondent. Of course, he's based here in Salt Lake. He returned just yesterday from the Gulf Coast, where he's been reporting on Katrina. And Howard, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So first, if you would, Howard, explain how did it work out that you came to cover the Gulf Coast of Mississippi? I mean, was this part of your coverage of rural America, or were they really just looking for bodies to cover this extraordinary story?
Well, NPR has mobilized more people for this story than I think for any other, including perhaps September 11th. We're actually establishing, for all intents and purposes, a bureau in New Orleans that will rival our bureau in Baghdad. We have probably at the moment maybe 15 people on the ground in Mississippi, Alabama, and Louisiana. And those people get worn out pretty quick. You're there for 10 days to 2 weeks. There are no days off. You're constantly filing, and you're seeing some of the most difficult things that a human being can witness day after day after day. So we're rotating people in and out. And I was very interested in going. I'm interested in going back. I plan to go back. I spent a couple of days at the Astrodome in Houston before I went to Mississippi. And I think as people have heard in the stories, it's a huge challenge to try to just describe what it's like. And, you know, the television pictures just don't do it justice. The camera lens has a fairly narrow frame of reference. When you pull back and you see with your own eyes mile after mile after mile after mile after mile of this kind of destruction that this hurricane has wrought, it just challenges your abilities to comprehend it and then convey it.
When you're trying to convey it, I mean, there's one thing having a limitation in a visual medium. What's the limitation of trying to convey it through radio?
There's just so much. You know, there is just there's just so much of it. I think of the town of Waveland, Mississippi, which is where the eye wall came ashore, the eastern edge of the eye wall came ashore. Probably 160-plus mile-an-hour sustained winds for hour after hour. And the old downtown of Waveland has a little main street that goes down to the waterfront. there is nothing recognizable as a building anymore. This used to be a neighborhood of homes and then shops along the street and trees, really a quite a beautiful place. Yeah. But there is nothing that is even close to looking like a house or a building. Where the town hall is, there's now a blue tarp and a sign that says town hall. Where a real estate office once was, there's simply a sign that says open house out on the sidewalk, which somebody, I think, placed there as a joke. But it's sensory overload. And then, of course, the stories that you hear from people.
Yeah.
Everybody has a story, and it's a story that's heart-wrenching. Everybody you talk to. And it's not a, for me at least, it's not a numbing experience. It's just, it just builds and builds and builds. So the issue, you know, the challenge is, what do you pick to say something about out of all that?
How did you find, or where did you find Betsy Balder, for example, in Waveland? Because you produced, it was kind of an audio portrait of just her experience.
Yeah, we were just driving down the street. I mean, again, you just have to point a microphone and you have a story and, yeah. and a gripping story. But yeah. We had actually just been in the town of Pearlington, which was also hit hard, one of the places that was hardest hit. And we were with a woman who was a volunteer with the emergency services agency in that county. And she said, I want to show you a place that's worse than what we just saw. And I said, there can't be any place worse than what we just saw. Yeah. And we drove into Pearlington or into Waveland and we're driving down this little main street. And I see this woman in the rubble, looking through the rubble, pulling things out of the rubble. And we hopped out of the car and I just went over and started talking to her. And it turns out that this was the shop that her mother owned, a cute little gift shop. And there, you know, she's finding a dollar bill or two, and there was one, or there were two intact ceramic sinks, but really there was just the foundation of the building. Most of the building was, you know, a mile or half a mile down the road, and she's looking through this stuff, and she's saying, "My parents haven't seen this yet," and then her mother drives up. They had been evacuated, and her mother drives up, and she bursts out of the car, and she's just wailing. She later we asked her if it was okay if we used that and if we talked to her, and she said it was, and we spoke with her. And this was, you know, her dream to build this shop. There's nothing left. She pulled a photograph out of her pocket, and she said, this is what it looked like. And it's as if a bomb just blasted that whole area. But that happened often. We would go out in the morning with a story idea, but we would just talk to somebody and all of a sudden we would have a completely different story. And we had so many of these stories that we started just posting them on our website because we couldn't get them in pieces.
Yeah.
Just so many of them. Heart-wrenching stories and where you would meet someone and the first question would be, you know, well, what happened with you? And then, you know, we ran into, for example, the woman who was running the deputy of the emergency operations system in Hancock County,
yeah.
Mississippi, which is where Waveland and Pearlington is. Again, one of the hardest hit places. We met her and we're talking to her about logistical things. And then somebody there said, ask her what happened to her. And so here she is. She's in emergency operations mode. She's trying to help people. And she said, well, you know, I lost my house. My car floated away. And I lost my 8-month-old grandchild who died when the air conditioning went out from the heat. You just hear stories like that over and over again. And it doesn't compare perhaps to anything that this country has ever endured. And it's ongoing. This will be going on for months and months.
I know you brought some tape, so I want you to feel free to play that for us as we fold those into the stories that you're talking about.
Here's a story that we were with this emergency worker from Hancock County, Mississippi, and we were stuck at a traffic light. The traffic is still pretty horrendous. And she said, tell me a story. This is number three on our CD here. She said she wanted to tell us a story about something that happened to her when she was in a shelter. Somebody came up to her.
It was 3 days after the storm, and I was at the EOC, and this little kid, about 17, I would estimate, came up to me and said that she just had to talk to somebody. She didn't know what to do, and I asked her what was wrong, and I hugged her, and she was crying, and she said that she had found her mom and dad's house, and there was a big X on the door. She didn't know what it was, but she went in and she found her mother and her father and her two younger brothers dead. And the thing that I guess she was in shock, because she just kept saying, and my mother was stinking, my mother stunk. And she said, and my mama never stunk. She took sometimes two baths a day. She hated to be dirty, and she stunk. And then she just broke down. It was just a very sad thing, and there's so many stories like that.
We also, other things that other kinds of stories that you continue to hear are the stories about people who still are trying to reunite their families.
Yeah.
When I arrived at the Astrodome in Houston, which was Labor Day, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children had reports of about 200 kids who were missing. Now that number's over 1,000. And these are people probably who've just been separated in this exodus that occurred. But I talked to a man at the Astrodome shelter in Houston who was sitting there filling out a form, you know, to sort of at the missing kids desk, they called it.
Yeah.
And this is the story that he told me.
Well, I was in a house that flooded. Water was about 30 feet high. Total disaster. Lost everything. I saved four families plus mine. They split us up. Now, I found my wife, Caesar, in Austin, Texas, somewhere. Now I'm trying to find the five kids that I lost. Man, it's heartbreaking, bro. I'm hurting, bro. Every day I can't sleep, stomach bad, nerves bad. I've been up for about a week. I ain't slept yet. I've been up trying to find my kids, walking, trying to find my kids, learn my way around a little bit, trying to find them, miss my family. That's all I can say.
And then he turned back to this piece of paper that he's filling out, and he listed, you know, five names of the children he was looking for. I left a couple of days after that, and I don't know whether he's found his children or not. But again, there are hundreds and hundreds of stories like that.
Howard, I wonder how you describe the way you have to separate, you know, yourself, your sort of personal reaction to it all, and your role as a, you know, as an objective observer. I mean, you have a child. I mean, and I wonder how difficult that was at times.
I don't think there's anything wrong with empathy or sympathy. My job as a reporter is to make sure that the best I can to make sure what I'm hearing is true. And that I'm fair to the people that I'm speaking with and the issues that I raise. I think as reporters, we do our listeners or viewers or readers more justice when we don't divorce ourselves from the emotional reactions that we have, and that we write from them. You know, we report from them. We still have to make sure, though, that we're fair, that we don't let that overwhelm our good sense and our good judgment. But I have no problem with reporters getting emotional, I suppose, about what's going on, as long as it helps inform their reporting and it doesn't get in the way of reporting. And I mean, I've seen some instances in which you know, reporters on live television have just kind of blathered on, and they're not telling me information. They're just emoting. That's not useful. And they're not telling me enough information about what they're emoting about for it to be useful to me. But I know there's been some discussion about whether reporters should cry on TV or whatever. Yeah. I don't – you know, we're human beings, and I don't see anything wrong with that as long as we're still honest and we're still fair and we're still trying to get at whatever notion of the truth we can get at.
NPR's Howard Berkus, he's NPR's rural affairs correspondent based here in Salt Lake City, just returned just last night from the Gulf Coast region where he's been reporting on the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. We invite you to join the conversation if you like. 585-WEST is our number, 585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We're going to take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on FM 90. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Last night, NPR's Howard Berkus returned to his home in Salt Lake City after covering the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. He reported from the Astrodome in Houston. He spent nearly 2 weeks traveling all over the Mississippi coast. Today in the program, Howard is joining us to talk about what he saw, the images, the voices, the sounds he captured of one of the country's most devastating disasters. Throughout the hour, we'll also hear from other observers what they, the impressions they gathered as they tried to report on Mississippi and Louisiana and the whole Gulf Coast as it tries to rebuild. We invite you to join the conversation. 585-WEST is the number, 585-9378. Our email address is radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us on the phone is Charles Bowden. He is a writer, the author of numerous nonfiction books. His writing regularly appears in national publications. His article on New Orleans after the hurricane will appear in November's GQ magazine. Charles Bowden joins us by phone from his home in Tucson. And Charles Bowden, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
Let me ask you this. You, in your article that's appearing in the upcoming GQ magazine, you write that New Orleans has become a movie that each viewer sees through a private lens. What do you mean?
Very simple. Everyone experienced it in the Gulf Coast, so they all have their own narrative. This is like the Kennedy assassination. Everybody tells you their story. The second thing is, once you leave that zone where people actually tasted the wind, the water, and the death and the ruin, everybody drags in their baggage right or left to deal with it. And it wears me out. This thing is too big for normal politics. This is like the Great Flood of 1927, which essentially shattered the Republican and Democratic parties down there. I don't know how this plays out politically, but it won't play out the way Mother Jones or Rush Limbaugh thinks. Mm. It's a demon let loose.
Tell us about Patrick, one of the people you found there.
He's a kind of a typical person of the projects. He's a 48-year-old man who couldn't at first remember his age, who had, before the hurricane struck, had lived by a disability pension and by stealing, he told me. After the hurricane struck, he was in the convention center and was terrified by what he saw, and then lived by stealing just to survive. And he was traumatized, and I don't think he's ever going back. And he's the person people see on television and say, ah, there's a looter, or ah, there's a survivalist. Once again, it depends what you bring to the screen yourself.
Mm-hmm. So it's hard to distinguish who Patrick was. That man, as you write, who was looting in this city, or that man who was starving, seeing that his pain or whatever had been ignored.
Yeah, well, what he was a guy determined to stay alive. Because he told me, and he was a big, hearty man, that he was really frightened in the convention center. And he said what frightened him was he was looking at younger men who were just like he was when he was younger. And he said there were demons let loose there, and he meant it. And he was just glad to be alive. But I don't think anybody knows what the consequence on individuals is of this hurricane. I don't think they've sorted it out. To be honest, I'm just the voyeur being paid by a magazine to go in there and look at it, and I haven't sorted it out. I have never seen We lost an entire city. That hasn't happened in my lifetime. We have a kind of aquatic Hiroshima, and I don't know what to make of it either, except it's a lot bigger than we first thought.
You have said that this, in some ways, this shouldn't really have been much of a surprise, that on one hand, on the economic terms, that New Orleans had been dying for years.
Decades. There's an excellent piece for people who can probe computers in the Atlantic Monthly, James Glassman, 1978, July. He writes about a city of 650,000 as literally terminal because of flight of jobs, industry, etc. Well, the New Orleans that went under the waves had about 450,000. It had continued dying apace. I'll give you a little statistic. The fabled port of New Orleans only employed 2,500 people on a peak day. That's why they had such massive unemployment in the city. This was a city on the skids. And then ecologically, a third of the wetlands have disappeared in the last 40 years down there, meaning the buffer. The city had continued to sink by dewatering its own environment. The river had continued to rise. This was a doomed city, and in a sense, everyone knew it. They just couldn't believe it because we'd never lost a city. And then Katrina arrived, and the bill was due.
So I wonder, I gather that what you're saying is in some ways that it's really too early to say what Katrina reveals. I mean, because in some ways, like Howard, who's here, and other people who are reporting on it, you know, beyond just talking about the meaning of the disaster, you've got all this coverage, just all of these stories to tell before you can get, it seems, in some ways, to the bigger meaning of it all.
We've got to think this one out. With all due respect to the president and all due respect to the mayor, rhetoric isn't going to matter in this case. I don't know what a new, better Gulf Coast means, and neither do they. The physical topography's changed. St. Bernard Parish lost a third of its land forever. It's now an ocean. The same thing's true in Plaquemine. They can't even find bodies down there. The strong was so severe, they either were washed out to sea or, as the locals say, snuffled off by alligators. I mean, we may have areas that were heavily populated that will never be populated again. And now with Rita in the pipeline, what your listeners have to understand is New Orleans is essentially defenseless. To the east of the city's levees were these massive levees built by the government as a kind of first defense, like a Maginot Line or something. They're gone. There's nothing out there now to stop the ocean. A small tropical storm could inundate the city, and it will take years just to reconstruct that. Secondly, the businesses have all moved to Baton Rouge, which doubled in size in 5 days. You know, and it goes on and on. Third, the most optimistic person would think we could save 50% of the buildings in New Orleans. I'm not that optimistic. We have a permanently changed location. There'll be a place called New Orleans. People will go there. Women will flash their breasts. Guys will throw beads. There'll be food. But it isn't going to be this metropolis that's bewitched us for several centuries. It's going to have less land, have a different population, and be something we can't imagine. It'll be the most interesting human reconstruction in this country since the Civil War, since we burned Atlanta and destroyed ourselves.
In your piece, Charles, you write, Katrina talked loud, damn near deafening. New Orleans meant something, and no one can quite put their finger on this something, but they know the music, can feel the lust, savor the cooking, and my God, they miss it so bad, whatever the hell it was.
I meant that. I was first in New Orleans as a boy. One of my aunts is a Cajun. She had a restaurant downtown when I was a child. I used to go out to see kinfolk who lived in those houses you see in pictures on stilts in the swamp. But I have a lifetime relationship with the city episodically, and you stand there on the levee, and you're looking at something that you think's out of a disaster movie, like a neutron bomb hit it. The buildings are all there, but the city's dead. It's a city of the dead. And what comes back, I have no idea. One of the things I intend to do is New Orleans for years has had this huge celebration of jazz called Jazz Fest, and that's going to be next April, and I'm going to go back for it to try and listen to the heartbeats. Because look at, I'm a normal American. I want my gumbo. I want the place that birthed Louis Armstrong. I want it all back. But by God, I don't see how we can do it. It's going to be something else next time.
Writer Charles Bowden. His article on New Orleans will appear in the November issue of GQ magazine. He joined us by phone from his home in Tucson. Charles, thanks.
Thank you.
585 West is the number to join the conversation. 585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. NPR's Howard Berkus, of course, with us, NPR's rural affairs correspondent. There's an image, aquatic Hiroshima.
Yeah, that's I wrote that down because that describes pretty well, although it doesn't take into account the wind. But the storm surge going into places that were never considered flood zones, so the people don't have flood insurance, and they're losing everything. The water reached places where human beings have not seen water reach miles inland. But then the wind on top of that, and places that the water didn't reach were decimated by the wind. 20 and 30 miles inland, I visited the northern end of Hancock County, Mississippi, where there's hardly a tree that hasn't been snapped in half. And in those three counties in Mississippi, they lost 30,000 power poles. They lost 4,000 miles of power lines, all that having to be replaced, snapped by most of it by the wind. It's a phrase that I think captures that sense of utter devastation there.
Did you want to go to Mississippi? Did you want to cover the story, anxious to see for yourself what was happening?
No reporter in their right mind would not want to go cover one of the biggest stories. But also, I wanted to go in part because I don't think this is just the Gulf Coast story. I mean, we're, one major earthquake away here from the same thing, in which our ability to respond quickly will be challenged in a way that none of us can possibly comprehend, and in which things may happen in ways that we cannot possibly comprehend. That's what happened down there, is that it exceeded the limits of people's comprehension. And that's something that has happened. It happened at Mount St. Helens. It will happen in places where there are other natural disasters that can take place. That's something that fascinates me. And the other thing is, I'm fascinated by people's capacity to respond to such things. Their inability to respond, and then the capacity to put together the resources to finally respond. And in addition to all the terrible things we've heard about Katrina has also become probably the nation's single largest philanthropic enterprise in the history of this country. And there are tens of thousands of people, maybe hundreds of thousands of people, showing up every day with tractor trailer trucks filled with supplies just on their own. And when the Red Cross person they go up to says, oh, you have we can't handle you here, or you need to fill out paperwork, or the FEMA guy says, sorry, you're not on the list, they just go to the next town, which is grateful to see them. And there's an enormous amount of that going on as well.
I'm wondering how you I guess it would be difficult from where you were to be able to sort of get a sense of really how anyone was covering it much. But I guess you may have gotten snatches here and there of some of the coverage in the papers and television stuff. And I'm wondering, did you? And are you making – what's your assessment of the way it's been being covered? I mean, what's the impression that we here so far inland are getting of that experience? Is it accurate?
I like what Charles Bowden said about we each have our own realities about this thing. He was referring to the people who experienced it. They each have their own story, so their own sense of reality. But we, the rest of us, it's the same way too. We only have what we hear. And I, working down there, I didn't have much chance to see other news. And actually, I don't think I ran into another single reporter, meaning that there was just so much in so many places that nobody was concentrated in one particular place, but But I think tomorrow we'll learn something that will challenge our image of what we think of as going on down there today.
Yeah.
That just keeps, every day we hear something new. We hear a different kind of story. We hear a different kind of theme. Early on, there were a lot of complaints. I was particularly interested in how rural places were responding because I'm the rural affairs correspondent. And early on, people were telling me, the rural places, they're last, and they get the last help and the least help. And so I went out and checked that out, and I found actually there was an embarrassment of riches in some of those places. There was more bottled water sitting in the middle school parking lot than there were people in the town. So that there was help going to some places. But I imagine that there are some places we may not have heard from yet.
Yeah.
I mean, there are places still where there's no phone, there's no water, there's no communication.
Well, wasn't Pearlington one of those places?
Pearlington was completely cut off for 3 or 4 days. A lot of places. Ocean Springs was completely cut off for 4 days. Ocean Springs is just across the bay from Biloxi, right off a freeway.
Yeah.
A lot of those places were cut off. The big lesson from this, the local public officials tell me, is don't depend on anybody. If you want to make it for the first 72 hours at least, you got to depend on yourself.
585 West is the number to join the conversation, 585-9378. Let's take a call. Gigi is calling from Draper. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey, I've been really moved by this whole disaster. I grew up in the South. I lived in New Orleans for almost 2 years, and I had to shut off the TV. I was so sad. First of all, two things that really concerned me is I saw a lot of racial discrimination. To say that all the poor people, 95%+ of people who were poor and black, who were left in New Orleans there to basically just fend for themselves, to say that it had nothing to do with racial discrimination is to say that the Civil War had nothing to do with slavery. It goes back to slavery. It goes back to that mentality. I grew up in the South, and I was taught that the Civil War was caused by state rights. When I came here to Utah and when I went to the East, I heard for the first time in my life when I was 18, 19 years old that it had to do with slavery, because that is just the mentality that you're taught in the South. Mm. And then my second thing, I really had a problem with people saying, we're going to have to try to rebuild New Orleans. It's not going to be rebuilt the way it was. All those poor people will always be gone. And so it's going to end up being like Manhattan, that the poor people will not have their base again. And that just has been really sad to me, because to have New Orleans without that sense of black community like it was is not going to have New Orleans again.
Gigi, we're glad you called.
Thanks.
Thanks very much. 585 West, again, the number, 585-9378. From your vantage point, Howard, I wonder, could you get a sense of the racial issues as they were playing out in those devastated communities?
I wonder if it's more an issue of class than race. There were elderly, poor white folk as well as poor black folk who were left behind. There were and non-elderly poor white folk. I don't know enough about that situation there, and I wasn't in New Orleans to say anything more than if there were issues of race there, I believe there probably also were as much questions of class. You had the one New Orleans suburb that wouldn't let people from New Orleans cross the bridge into their town. On the Gulf Coast, I have to say that while we have heard about and we're still checking into some allegations that white neighborhoods were helped first over black neighborhoods, all that I saw was a mix where everybody was pretty much helped the same way or not helped the same way. I didn't see any overt examples of discrimination in that way, at least based on race. We do know that in Gulfport there was a shelter set up in a wealthier part of town as opposed to a poorer part of town, which may have had something to do with what buildings were available. I don't know. But that kind of thing does serve to disadvantage then the people on the other side of town who may not have the means to get somewhere. And there were a lot of silly things done that aren't about race, but I do think about class and about missing what goes on in a disaster like this. Like the Red Cross and FEMA were handing out brochures to people telling them how to sign up for assistance, and this involved making phone calls. These things were being handed out to people who didn't have houses, let alone phones anymore, and there was no phone service. Cell phone service still is out in much of that area. Phone service is still out in a lot of it. Some of it may have just been blundering. Some of it may have been race. I don't know.
NPR's Howard Berkus is with us. He is NPR's rural affairs correspondent based here in Salt Lake City. We invite you to join us. 585-WEST is the number, 585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We're going to take another brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on FM 9. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking to some of those who have been covering the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, sharing some of the images and some of the sound and voices that they've collected along the way. We invite you to join the conversation. 585-WEST is the number, 585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Just 4 days after Hurricane Katrina struck, the human consequences of the storm and its aftermath began to sink in. Those of us listening to National Public Radio began to understand the immensity of the storm from NPR's John Burnett. He was speaking to Robert Siegel on a cell phone on NPR's program All Things Considered.
After speaking with Secretary Chertoff, we were joined on the line by NPR's John Burnett, who had been to the convention center earlier in the day.
Let me clarify for the Secretary and for everyone else what myself and Producer Ann Hawk just drove away from three blocks from here in the Ernest Morial Convention Center. There are, I estimate, 2,000 people living like animals inside the City Convention Center and around it. They've been there since the hurricane. There's no food. There's absolutely no water. There's no medical treatment. There's no police and no security. And there are two dead bodies lying on the ground and in a wheelchair beside the convention center, both elderly people, both covered with blankets now. We understand that two other elderly people died in the last couple of days. We understand that there was a 10-year-old girl who was raped in the convention center in the last two nights. People are absolutely desperate there. I've never seen anything like this.
NPR's John Burnett speaking with Robert Siegel on the program All Things Considered. John Burnett is joining us now. He's NPR's Southwest correspondent based in Austin. He is in New Orleans now and joining us by cell phone. John, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Doug. Good to be here.
So this conversation you had with Robert at that point, I guess it's some 4 days, as we mentioned, after the storm, was this when you, as a reporter, were starting to realize the real immensity of the story?
We knew the dimension of the story by this time. It was just being driven home hour by hour that the conditions that we were seeing were everywhere. People were living in that desperate fashion, on top of elevated interstates, in the convention center, kind of grouped together in intersections, there was no one to help them. We spoke to one of the city council persons who was with the mayor throughout this ordeal, and she was in tears, and she said, "We could not help our people. Everything had broken down. It was a calamity that few American cities have faced in my lifetime."
When you started your coverage, when you first arrived there, was there a story you had in mind, or I'm wondering how you describe what you were trying to convey in those early hours and of the aftermath of the storm? Was it just, again, the stories of the chaos, I suppose?
Well, I've covered a lot of hurricanes, and I thought this was going to be one more hurricane, and I really wasn't prepared for the immensity of the suffering and the destruction. I really think what happens in a situation like this for journalists, whether television or print or radio, is that in some ways the language almost doesn't convey the depth of emotion and of pain that's going on in these situations, it's as though words fail to describe this. And so you end up, you know, the devastation gets sort of repeated endlessly. You know, we hear TV reporters talking about, you know, near Armageddon. I mean, as a nuclear bomb, which is over the top. I mean, we need to state that, you know, there are many buildings that are standing here also. It's quite remarkable to try to put some of this stuff into words.
NPR's Howard Berkus is here as well, talking about the fact that NPR has been shuttling reporters in and out of that experience as it gets to be trying. You've been there a long time. I'm wondering, what's the level of, I guess, professional physical exhaustion for you?
You know, it's kind of like war coverage in some way. I mean, you come here and you need to be self-sufficient. You need to be able to live out of your car and work without power, which means satellite phones and working off the car battery and kind of noshing with what you've brought. I think as the story unfolded and we began to talk to more and more people out of the neighborhoods in desperate circumstances, and they didn't see us as journalists. They saw us as people who could help them, people who had something, and they had nothing. And so they needed information. They wanted to know where buses were. They needed water. They needed food. And there are times in journalism when you feel somewhat powerless holding a reporter's pad and a microphone, even though I think the information we were able to transmit from the eye of the catastrophe was very helpful in getting the attention of federal authorities. But it's a very frustrating feeling sometimes when we can't do more.
I had a little girl walk up to me in the Astrodome. She was probably about 6 years old. And she said, "Can you help me find my daddy?" And it's, as John said, it's, you know, we're there with a pad and we can put some of those things on the air, and news organizations have been doing that. But you do feel somewhat helpless.
John, you're still obviously in the thick of it there. Is the story that you're reporting changing? Are you seeing a kind of evolution in the way you're reporting it or the things that are going on?
Definitely. The acute pain is not here as much now. I mean, I think when people start coming back in large numbers and we record how they react to their filthy, drowned houses, you know, it's the emotion, I think, is going to ratchet back up. Right now, there are a large number of people who are sweating in the sun trying to clean this city up and trying to clean these buildings out. And there are many, 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 you know, blue-collar workers and immigrants coming from all over the country to do this dirty work. And right in this very instant, there are a lot of people who are panicked about this next oncoming hurricane, and so it's really raised the anxiety level again. It reminds me of people that I met in Nicaragua during an earthquake, and after a big earthquake, and then the tremor comes, and they all run out in the street screaming again. And that's they're not screaming here, but there is an anxiety level that's definitely on the increase right now.
NPR Southwest correspondent is John Burnett. He joined us by cell phone from New Orleans. John, thanks very much.
It's been a pleasure, Doug.
So, Howard, John is talking about that you sort of nosh when you can. You use a battery to sort of get power. What was it like for you, living in these kind of makeshift circumstances?
Actually, we were living in real circumstances compared to what John and Ann Hawk, his producer, and some of the other people who were in New Orleans in those early days had. They were without power. They were able to get to a hotel that had working toilets. And we actually could not get housing on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. We had to stay in Alabama about an hour to 2 hours from the places in the Gulf Coast we wanted to be, so we would commute in every day. We did a lot of driving. All the hotel rooms that are left, there are hundreds of hotels that are closed, but those that are left are filled with FEMA workers and Red Cross workers and contractors and reporters and evacuees. So we were staying a good distance away, which means that we lived fairly well. But once you went into the zone, you know, your phones weren't working. You didn't have power to plug into. So we did the same thing. We used the car battery to power our laptop, to power our satellite phone.
585 West is the number to join the conversation, 585-9378. Let's go to the phone. Scott is joining us in Salt Lake. Scott, forgive me. Welcome.
Hi. Not sure how to word this, but I've been on several disasters with the Red Cross and FEMA, and I'm just wondering, what will it take in our leadership or our will to start looking at these areas that are prone to disasters and really say, okay, it happened here, we'll give you this one-time money to stay on your own, but if it happens again, you're going to be on your own, rather than spending these billions of dollars year after year rebuilding these places. It just keeps happening to it. And why can't we just gradually move back a zone area in these disaster areas where, you know, a couple miles, 5 miles, 10 miles, where it's not buildable unless you want to do it on your own?
Well, you know, that actually happened to some degree after Hurricane Camille hit the Gulf Coast. And there were places that were not rebuilt. There are communities on the Gulf Coast where the first street is 4th Street. And that's because they didn't bother to rebuild 1st, 2nd, and 3rd Street.
Wow.
I think the problem is that this is a hurricane of a magnitude that has not occurred, I don't believe, in human history in that place. And what is our capacity to anticipate the kinds of disasters that might occur in a place? We have the example here along the Wasatch Front. To some degree, I think what you're saying is a valid public policy issue. Should we have cities below sea level along the coast? That's a pretty good public policy question that needs to be debated. But if you extend it to all the places that are in peril, there wouldn't be many places left, given tornadoes that can drop anywhere from the sky in the Midwest, given the fact that most of the population of this state lives on one of the most active earthquake faults in the country, given what the San Andreas fault and the population along there. I think it is a valid question to ask, but it's one where if you start thinking about it deeper, it raises a question about, is any place really safe from something, from everything? And what should we do about that? And there probably isn't much we can do except be prepared as much as possible.
Well, I agree, but I mean, like for instance, in the Mississippi floods, there were certain towns, small towns and areas that they did do that. They, in fact, Valmire, or a small city, said, we're not going to build back in this floodplain. We're going to go up on the hill. We're going to take this FEMA money and rebuild our town back there. And it happened in a few places. And I know you can't do it everywhere, but I'm saying where it's a continual known fact that it's going to happen, you know. But like in tornado places, no, you can. And like where the Wasatch Front, yeah, you don't know when and where it's going to hit. But these year after year events that we can predict, you know, it's just a matter of time. Then I think we should really look at those places differently.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right about that. Certainly floodplains, and actually not permitting construction to go on in places that are going to be prone to disaster, like the like in historic landslide areas. We have neighborhoods here that are built in those kind of places, or as you say, in floodplains that have flooded over and over again. I think you're absolutely right about that.
Scott, we're glad you called.
Thanks
a lot. 585 West, again, the number 585-9378. Lisa Rosetta is joining us on the line, social justice reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Lisa has just returned from New Orleans, is speaking to us from her office in Salt Lake. Lisa, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, tell us, if you would, your reaction now that you're back. We've been talking about, I know it's a cliche to say it's indescribable, but how are you describing your experience of covering what was happening in New Orleans?
Well, a different word than indescribable, I would say incomprehensible. The loss of life and property is truly amazing. And one thing that really impressed me being down there is you certainly can't get a true sense of what is down there watching the television or reading the newspaper. You know, when my first day in New Orleans, I was overcome with the smell of the city. There is this stagnant seawater stench coupled with fuel, oil, and certainly the stench of dead bodies. Within 5 minutes of stepping out of my car, I saw two of them lying at the end of an exit ramp. The emergency officials there are dealing with it by throwing blue tarps over the bodies and pinning them down with tires. And so certainly it was eye-opening and humbling to see how vulnerable human beings can be in a time of natural disaster. And it's certainly just a real wake-up call, and especially for Utahns who, as it was mentioned earlier in the show, are living on an active fault line. This kind of disaster is possible here. We're not immune from a similar situation occurring here, and I think that has been something that has really followed me home as I return to Salt Lake City and look at the infrastructure and the people here and wonder, what would it look like when that happens?
Lisa Rosetta is social justice reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. She's joining us from her office in Salt Lake City. Howard Berkus, we don't have much time left, but I wanted to... You talked about the fact that there were those signs of hope, those images of hope. Tell us briefly, if you would, about Ocean Springs, Mississippi, because it had one of, for me anyway, one of those enduring images of hope, I guess.
A place where there's hardly a tree left standing, century-old oaks, just ripped right out by their roots, and all the leaves on trees and pine needles killed by the salt water. But the mayor noticed something while I was interviewing her the other day, that some of the trees, the fruit trees and the nut trees, have spring blossoms on them. And her theory is that when the leaves died, the trees were sort of tricked into thinking it was spring. But she takes that as a sign of hope. And it is that here in the sweltering heat of September, it was 95 degrees there, that spring blossoms are appearing on the trees.
Howard Berkus is National Public Radio's rural affairs correspondent. He joined us here in the studio. Howard, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
And Lisa Rosetta, social justice reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Lisa, thanks very much for being with us. Radio West is a production of KUER News. The program is directed by Mike Anderson, produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.